So the question is, you hate cores that aren't doing work, even if they're little GPU cores that are just sipping power. Absolutely. So this falls in the general performance optimization umbrella of the best optimization is to identify the work you don't need to do and stop doing it. Right? That's been true for 40 years, and it continues to be true. It's just in different kinds of places and cracks that you have to ferret it out and stop doing it, such as by not being too fine-grained, making sure you do more work per unit. Sometimes you will find it's faster, although it uses slightly more power, it's faster to waste threads on the GPU. Sometimes you will run faster by spinning up more threads than you actually use and some of them idle. Like when you do halos, for example, halo computations, and you do box blur is a good example, because you go one past in every direction for pixels and those overlap. Turns out spinning up extra threads for those sometimes on some platforms is an optimization, even though they then just load the data and do nothing. But yes, we want to stop doing needless work no matter what we're using.
As a general rule, computing has always had competing trends and requirements, so this is nothing new. You should, however, expect that in parallel and distributed computing, there's going to be a certain amount of wasted computational power. It can be very counterintuitive that some computation that looks pretty wasteful, actually, this is the way it works. Actually, Herb's example of computing a sum by reducing successively, it may look pretty wasteful at the first sight, when in fact this is part of for a course. I expect this issue to be essentially be solved like just on any other trade-off in engineering by, people are going to be intelligent and find interesting solutions.
So the question is, does C++ AMP build on PPL? How is it integrated? So right now it's in the same namespace, concurrency, :, parallel for each. It's an overload. Currently they are disjoint. One overload, the existing one, which we're also improving in this release, but that existing one does multi-core and spreads across multi-core with work stealing, and this overload runs on GPU and takes a restrict AMP function, a restricted lambda. There is no reason why, not in this first release, but we absolutely plan in the future to have the regular parallel for each take a restrict AMP, and then you can just spread that across the entire machine of both kinds of cores from the same parallel for each, and the same for the other function to be able to spread that across multi-core. As an engineering point in time, those are separate overloads right now, but they are absolutely going to be unified. The whole goal is to write parallel for each and spread it across whatever you have, local and elastic cloud. So the question is, what about operating system scheduling for GPU operations? Multi-core, even normal multi-core where the OS schedules threads, it doesn't do all the scheduling we want already because TBB and PPL have their own schedulers to do task stealing. GPUs also are not integrated with the OS yet, although the DirectX stack, for example, and others like it, do know more and more about both kinds of computation. In previous GPU, you would spin up a computation and your screen would start doing this because you're also using the graphics card for compute. They're making that much smoother these days. For example, if you have a bunch of warps or a bunch of threads in a group, say 1,500, and you have your 750 for your computation, somebody else could be using the other 750 for their parallel for each computation or for graphics. They're getting much better about scheduling, not integrated in the operating system yet, but it's moving in that direction. That's the way all specialty technologies start, and then they move in.
Okay, so the question essentially is, what do I expect is going to happen while we're in this transition period from essentially platforms having their own memory model, whatever it happens to be, moving over to the standard memory model? I expect there's going to be some comparatively small mismatches between what people were used to and whatever the new memory model is, but there always was a memory model before. It might have been dictated by the hardware that you were on. It might have been dictated by the particular operating system or compiler vendor that you happen to be using. And I think people have recognized for quite a while that the model people wanted to have was sequential consistency. Mm-hmm. People have recognized that for 10 years. The question is, how do we actually offer that to them? But given that the high-level goal fundamentally hasn't changed, it's kind of a matter of what are the underlying details, and then what is the API that people use in order to get that, I think that it's probably not going to be a dramatic problem to migrate from whatever you've been using to the new thing, and there's actually some stuff involving. Some of the stuff I'll talk about tomorrow, these relaxed atomics, these low-level atomics, and one of the reasons they specifically put those in there was to make it easier for people with existing code bases that were already doing stuff that used relaxed operations to give them a way to rewrite that in a standard way and still get essentially the same semantics. So the short answer to your question is that I don't anticipate there's going to be, you know, massive problems, but there is going to be an adjustment, as is typical whenever you move from one platform to another similar platform.
Most of the change will just be in atomics, a portable way to write atomics. Because remember, the memory model basically just is a contract that says, I guarantee I don't write a race condition. I can't tell the difference between that and sequential consistency, between that and it just running the source code. I like to explain sequential consistency as I can read my source code and it's as if it executed in source code order. It's the only thing I can reason about. That's what it really means. That means to not write a race, if I have a shared variable, I protect it with a lock or an atomic. And guess what? Mutexes have worked for decades. We already got that part right. So the memory model is, for mutexes, is a formalization of, well, do the right thing that everybody has already figured out. It's the, how do I write portable atomics and fences where things have had wonderful variety and where we're now culling some of that variety and reining it in and saying, look, let's just play nice in the sequentially consistent atomic way. That's the part that's catching up and that we'll soon have.
It's frankly, if you live in a world of sequential consistency, which is the world you should live in, those of you who think you're wrong, you know who you are. It's more work for the compiler writers, actually, than it is for you. Because you've been trying to do sequential consistency anyway, but the compiler writers have to stop doing some optimizations they've been doing before. The question essentially is, now that there's going to be a memory model, is this going to have some performance penalty, essentially? Every compiler vendor has already had a memory model. So it's just that now there's a standard memory model. And it's interesting, if you were to go and read the motivational documents behind the design of the C++ memory model specifically, what you're going to read over and over is, no matter what we do, we have to make sure that compiler optimizers can continue to do all the valid things that they have been doing. And we have to make sure that if somebody's running on a machine which makes a particular kind of relaxed optimization worthwhile, programmers still have access to it. So I don't expect that there's going to be any negative performance penalty at all, really, because that was a pretty strong design constraint.
I think the way we could be looking at it is consolidation more than a dramatic change in any way. So essentially, people are going to be happy to have a standard to look at when essentially they define their their compilation model. I don't foresee any dramatic these improvements or improvements in the way compilers handle things. It's great that it's standard. This is pretty much it. Think of C++ proper in 1994, when everybody implemented templates or implemented exceptions. There are a million little differences. And when it got standardized, everybody was happy that there was a standard and they just did whatever little adjustments there had to be. So I presume the similar the history is going to rhyme again in the next few years.
We're very much right now in a way where we were in the late 1990s,
yeah,
where we had a developing standard and people were developing talks, including you and Andre and folks, about how which compilers
back then, but, you know,
which compilers support what parts of the standard well and what can you do in portable code. And we're in the same place again, just with a little less variety, but really it's very much like the late 1990s again. Mm-hmm. And once again, Andre is talking about, well, here's what the standard says you could do, but no compiler supports it, but this code would work, and then shames all the compilers into making it so.
Gonna see more of that tomorrow.
Is that a promise or a threat?
Some of both. Next question.
He's all never right. Met a template.
I guess you're gonna reschedule. Okay. Yes.
Oh, the question was, aren't lambdas wonderful? No, seriously,
the
question.
You got a hell of an accent. I didn't hear that at all. So.
Seriously, the question was more along the lines of, well, what about functional programming and functional languages, and how important are they for parallelism? The techniques. Well, yes, but vary. But people often ask also, well, are functional languages going to take over because they seem more suited to parallelism? That was a big thing maybe 3-4 years ago. And the answer is they have not taken over and never will, because we're just not all going to learn to write in functional languages. It's just not a style people can get. But they've already taken over because they've infected all of the mainstream languages. Every single mainstream language, even Java in Java 8 finally, I'm sure someday, will get lambda functions. C# has had them for a while. C++ has them in a standard way now. The idea of immutability is already used. Those are the two biggies. Those and pure functions, those kinds of things are coming. Those are the big things in functional programming. So we already do it, and we do it to great profit.
The only thing I would add to that is I would be... One of the advantages of functional programming is that you do have pure functions, you know, there's no side effects, and compilers can then optimize on that basis. And we're still living in a language that has pointers and references and separate compilation models. And I think it's going to be really difficult for compilers to take advantage of other optimization opportunities that would come from a pure function, because in general they can't know that it's pure. Even if you're using a lot more functional style with pure functions and stuff, you know, lambdas can still modify anything they want to. You can pass pointers and stuff to them. So I don't have any evidence, but I would be skeptical of expecting miracles because of the existence of things like pure functions.
We really need a way to declare and advertise in the name mangling and enforce that a function is pure, and that would solve that problem. Yeah. We should work on that.
Yeah. Does D do pure, Andre?
D must do pure
this
functions.
This is functional programming means many things to many people. To just off the top of my head, functional programming can mean first class functions. Functions are values. Here's where lambda come forth. It means true immutability of data. It means pattern matching and first match, which is sort of counterintuitive a bit, but actually virtually all functional languages have pattern matching and first match policy. Who knows a functional language of any kind? So essentially, in a functional language, the way it works, you define so-called overloads of the same function, and they match on the shape of the argument. So if you, you define the same function, and it works one way for an integer, works one way for a tree with two descendants, it works a different way for a tree with two descendants, and so on. So you define all of these overloads, and essentially the first match is going to be taken. This is very opposite to object-oriented languages, which have a best match policy, which is whenever you have an overloaded and or overridden function method, as it would be, there would be the best match, right? So to continue, so I said first class functions. Functions are values, lambdas. True data immutability, pattern matching and first match, and what else? Purity of functions. Functions results depend only on inputs. So there are these four dimensions. I think there has been, I disagree with Herb, I think there has been a great recrudescence, as I like to call it, of functional languages in the past years, exactly because imperative languages have a much poorer proposition for distributed and parallel computing. Erlang, for example, Erlang has been around since 1984. It has been essentially told in obscurity, and I got word from a person working at Ericsson, even Ericsson doesn't care about it anymore. But, you know, but essentially there are now books, and there's a revival of Erlang, you know, which is a language that, who knows Erlang? So I can lie, through my teeth here. So, for example, like one character is, strings are, each character is like 8 bytes. It's just ridiculous. But Erlang does have a strong proposition in terms of combining functional programming with distributed computing, and it's very elegant that particular way. There's a lot of interest in Haskell that's very recent. Haskell is essentially the language everybody wishes knows. It's just like the opera. Everyone's like, yeah, Othello, I've been there, yeah. You know, of course, I've read Jane Eyre. But it turns out there's, again, Haskell has been around for a long time, decades already, and it's only now enjoying an increasing popularity. So I disagree that the trend is dwindling in terms of functional languages. Of these four dimensions, my opinion is that C++ does not rate very well. So we have, I said, first-class functions. We have lambdas, great. But it kind of stops here because there's no true immutability, there's no true purity, and there's no pattern matching. Pattern matching, actually, we can eliminate because it's not very relevant to parallel computing, right? But the other two, which I think are essential, are true immutability, provable during compilation, and functional purity, they're, let's face it, they are not in the standard C++ language.
They're not in the standard C++ language.
That kind of stops the buck right there. So I would have hoped there would have been more of a push that way, but the push is towards the relatively complicated, mutability intensive approach with STD Atomic.
What other things in C++ OX might we how did you put it? What performance pitfalls might we pitfall into? That was quite nice. And we talked about a few yesterday in the panel.
Returning by value, I guess.
Specifically about performance.
Specifically about performance.
Yeah. Don't return by value.
No, that's pretty much it. Now.
Unless
it's totally free.
Unless you have move. Oh, and by the way, don't pass reference counted pointers by value. Ranged. What about the work on ranges, and wouldn't they help parallelism?
Yes.
Andre did some work on that.
The question, so just to clarify, ranges are essentially pairs of iterators, but they're made first class in the sense that you don't have access to begin and end separately. You just have access to the range as a unit. Ranges are better than iterators at computing because they have a more. Let me first compare and contrast. So, who knows about boost ranges? Boost range library, right? So there is such a thing in C++. It's not in a standard. There is talk about migrating into the standard. It didn't materialize yet. Ranges do help parallel computing a great deal because simply with two iterators you're having aliasing issues and you're having a number of they could be coming from disjoint arrays and all of these errors and bugs that might be there. But most importantly, it's about aliasing issues. Once you encapsulate everything, the two iterators within a range, you have a block, actually array view, remember? From 40 minutes ago, array view is actually a range. So they're pretty essential to good parallel and distributed computing. I presume organically ranges are going to materialize themselves in the shape of array view and things like that for the sheer reason that they do help a lot. Unfortunately, they're not in the standard, but I just see this as a grassroots movement from parallelism intensive libraries. They're just going to define ranges. I'm very happy that the language is expressive enough to support them almost seamlessly.
In particular, one form of a range and that I think is very important, and not just because it's central in AMP, but because it's something we've just realized is very central. As we were developing that model and we realized the importance of an array view, more and more as we kept refining it and answering design questions and nailing it down, several times in our design meetings, one of us would stop and say, the more we do this, the more we're bringing Fortran arrays into the language. Then a few weeks later, we'd say the same thing again. And so this is a path where for high-performance computing, Fortran knows what it's doing until Fortran 90 and aliasing. But anyway, except for that part. So do the right Fortran parts. Bring those arrays into the language because arrays are lovable containers. Have ranges of those in particular are important for parallel computing. And the nice thing about that is they lend themselves very nicely to distribution because you can see the subsets that you're viewing and then move only that to whatever compute node, remote or local, that you need to do, whether it's in box or out of box. Well, everybody needs an out-of-box experience every so often.
I would add that it's Fortran arrays are coming back, but with a vengeance. They're not coming back just the way they were like 40 years ago, mm-hmm. 50 years ago, 55 years ago. So they
time
come back
flies,
with,
aren't they?
Yeah. So they come back with a vengeance in the sense that ranges are generalized arrays, meaning that they could iterate over other shapes than just blocks of memory. For example, it's a classic in high-performance libraries. You have a stride, right? You essentially have a chunk of memory, and you have a stride. You have a step. You don't move through the array element by element. You just jump through it with a fixed stride, and that actually helps, for example, things like matrix multiplication and whatnot. So for ranges are generalized arrays the same way iterators are generalized pointers. So, when Stepanov came up with iterators, everyone was like, oh, C pointers are coming back, essentially, and whoa, what's going to happen? Iterators are much better than pointers because they generalize pointers in the same way ranges actually generalize the Fortran-style arrays, but they are much more than that.
The question was, yes, but Fortran arrays also have things like slicing as well as striding and stuff, and you're saying, I don't know if that's in C++ AMP. At this moment, as I stand here, I don't know if it's above the cut list, but it's coming. I said, it looks more and more like Fortran arrays every week you look at it. Because it turns out to be the Fortran people actually had some good ideas.
Yeah, don't forget that ranges are divorced from representation. Just the same way iterators may iterate pretty much anything. So the iterator doesn't specify I'm a pointer within an array, and incrementing mm-hmm. me means moving to the next exact section of the next element in the array. It could actually jump to a whole different element in a list. The same way, the range does not mean I'm going to be a slice within an array. It could it's representation independent. As long as you have the primitives in place, it could jump through lists, iterate trees, hash tables, you name it.
So, for example, just to talk about the array views that I'm familiar with, apart from things like strides, which are there, and there's also things like project. Now, one of the design choices that we made for this release is that array view, you know how it's n-dimensional? You can project it down to other dimensions. And the only artificial, and it is an artificial restriction, is that we require the lowest dimension to be contiguous. That is not necessary for correctness. It is very helpful for performance to avoid people falling into performance pitfalls, to have the lowest dimension be guaranteed to be contiguous. So there is one projection we don't let you do. Everything else you can project and stride to your heart's content. Like I said, Fortran wasn't stupid. Yeah. There's a lot of goodness. How many of you still, like several of you have mentioned to me already, how many of you use Fortran to good effect even today? Several in the audience. See, we're not bigots.
Coming soon, column major order.
Yeah, it's in BLAS already.
Negative indexes.
Oh, you can do negative indexes. The extents you can have arbitrarily numbered.
The question would about debugging.
Oh, the question, parallel debugging, would be just imagine everything you can do, for instance, specifically in Visual Studio 2010 today for parallel cores for multi-core. If you haven't seen that, you can download a free version and play with it, or just read the documentation online. If you've seen it, imagine that for GPU, just now with hundreds of threads or more instead of just tens or dozens.
Do they have debugging capabilities?
Do GPUs have debugging capabilities in general? Oh, whoa, I wish they had better. But you can build on top of it anyway.
Debug GPU but not CPU at the same time and vice versa.
There are limitations in many current products, but the tools are absolutely getting better. And they're getting better almost as fast as the hardware is getting better year by year. So the question is, so C++ AMP has this today and this tomorrow. When I talk about, oh yes, and these two are right on the cut list or are coming in V next, how cooked and baked is it? The way that we like to do design is you always look, okay, where are we now? Where do we want to be, irrespective of release? What is the right place to be? Take into account cloud. Take into account projection strides. Take into account all the things you need to do. Design that. And then make sure you ship a subset of that, whatever makes sense and holds together well, that's usable in this release, but is on a direct path to that, so you can then just continue to take people down that path because you know where you're going. So I'm mostly talking about stuff we're going to ship right now, in the next few months. but I'm also telling you about things, about where the road is leading, so you know where we're taking you, and you can opt out now if you think that's not a great place to go. But so you have some idea of, yes, these things are already considered and are part of this design so that it can evolve in that direction as opposed to going west, it's going north. Yeah.
So it's going to extend, but it's not going to be majorly revised. It's not going to be a brand new.
The intent is not to majorly revise it. In fact, my biggest goal is that you can take V1 and write parallel for each grid, lambda restrict today and have it run on GPU. And then in some future revision, hopefully not far away, be able to take that same code and recompile it with zero or few changes and spread it across multiple GPUs on a cloud. Without changing your code or changing it much. That's the goal.
Actually, it should be admitted, Microsoft has a good track record at being backward compatible. So, you know,
end of inventing
I'm
new
not
stuff.
Kidding. You could still run Windows 2.0 stuff on Windows. And
you can run MS-DOS apps really well.
Yeah, and you know, as opposed to like, you know, Macintosh, like 10.6 is, they don't care about 10.4. You know, it's just, forget them. You know?
I didn't say it.
So,
it's,
which is odd.
So the question is, SIMD is popular, MIMD is wonderful. And so the question, so first of all, let's define the terms for everybody. How many are familiar with SIMD besides the talk today? Okay, so you do a parallel instruction. It's instruction level parallelism, I do, which means I'm doing the same instruction on multiple data, which means very short programs, one instruction, and you really need to do the same things lockstep. MIMD, multiple instruction, multiple data, you know, threading and those kinds of things, that's great. NVIDIA loves to press the term SIMT, single instruction, multiple threads, to talk about warps, for example, that really want to do their instructions and those kinds of artifacts. So there's lots of acronyms. You can have your acronym soup and pepper it and spice it the way you like. The main issue is just how much parallelism can I express, how similar does it have to be, and how much can the underlying system and hardware tolerate variety, because there's going to be variety. And if it can't tolerate variety, you got to jump through a hoop or two like we showed today to arrange things so that similar things stay close together. But hey, we've been doing that kind of thing for a long time with data, now also with code paths. So I think it's a smaller thing to learn. It applies on some hardware more than others, but it's more about keeping similar things together and seeing where we can tolerate variety, and we'll get better at that in the hardware.
But by the way, just a second. There is a considerable concern in the parallel distributed computing community about this particular question, and you know, just to clarify, like MIMD is really classic multi-threading, like the kind we do, like with completely independent threads. They do their own thing. They may or may not be doing the same thing at any given point in time. They occasionally synchronize. They occasionally share data. They occasionally have bugs and, you know, race conditions and all that good stuff. So the MIMD is really general purpose multi-threading. And there is, you know, a number of studies have shown that for typical desktop computing workloads, more than 8 cores are not going to improve the experience, because people are not going to be willing to do more than 8 things at a time, even though many of those would be hidden in background. So beyond 8 cores on a desktop machines, you can't use general multi-threading to good effect, or general multi-processing. Therefore, many people are saying, you know, we're going to have a trend in which there's going to be a number of kernels, of computational kernels, that are going to be SIMD in nature, and they're going to do interesting stuff that's essentially very important for us. For example, speech recognition is going to be one of these things in which there's a small kernel. It essentially crunches numbers and is going to be SIMD in nature, but it's going to do something at a human perception level. It's going to be pretty cool, right? So you're with your laptop here, and you know, you transcribe everything we talk, even with my accent in tow, right? Which would be quite a trick. There's going to be a number of kernels like speech recognition, handwriting, shape recognition, face and everything. Like Facebook knows what you look like and who you are, who your friends are, right? So there's going to be a number of tasks important to a human being that are very SIMD-ish in nature, and that computers are going to be very good at. I presume that that's going to be a very important trend. For MIMD, I also think there are a number of workloads, such as a web server is an absolutely typical MIMD task workload, right? Because the web server can serve any page to anyone at any second, and there's a lot of stuff going on in parallel, but not in a not in an SIMD manner. It's not lockstep at all. So I presume both are going to see a lot of attention. But I really think that MIMD has been more popular, and I think that SIMD is going to be very interesting to watch, because again, at the end of the day, you're going to have you're going to have an iPad or the portable device of that nature that's that understands what you say, and it's a virtual secretary, and say when's my next meeting, and it's going to say it's already you're late. stuff like that, right? You're late, moron, and stuff like that. So it's going to be interesting what's going to happen in that space. And that is all SIMD. That stuff is fundamentally very computation intensive, very kernelized work, very numeric intensive. And, if computers are going to get, 1,000 to 1 million times better at simply SIMD tasks, I predict that these simple AI tasks are going to be entirely attainable. Now, sorry for the long answer.
It's okay.
All right.
But I have something to say. So let me try to agree, but also try to clarify, because I think what you're saying is right, but I'd like to tease...
As long as it don't destroy.
I'm tease some
way.
Things apart.
Just, as long as it don't destroy.
You're supposed to stand in the way of the dragon fire.
All right.
Uh-huh. Yes. You're already wearing the correct color shirt.
All right.
So the idea is, yes, there's a difference between threading and parallelism. But it's not just about SIMD. Remember, that's because SIMD is very tactical. It's instruction, multiple data, single instruction. You don't have to be lockstep instruction. So SPMD, single program, multiple data, SIMT, those are all kinds of things that are interesting as well. I think what the important distinction actually is, which agrees with you, but I'm going to try to categorize it a different way. Here's a slide from probably the most important slide from Effective Concurrency. It's from my first Effective Concurrency column as well. There are three pillars of concurrency. The first two are about expressing concurrency or parallelism. The third one's about consistency, locks and atomics, making sure you don't stomp over your state. So that one's not relevant for here. This is just housekeeping to keep your world sane, and memory model falls in here. Expressing concurrency and parallelism, there is a difference. There's concurrency, that's where threads come in, and we should be using active objects and things like that, and patterns that promote messaging for here. The goal of this pillar is not to use 100 cores or 1,000 to get the answer faster. The goal here is to let independent work run independently and message back and forth asynchronously. That's the best practice. That's what we should be doing, not just having raw threads touch mutable shared state. We want to avoid that. But all of that is still this column. Even if you're using threads, you're in this column. So when people say, oh, multi-core, we'll just write more threads, and we say threads are not the answer, all we mean is threads are about pillar one. They're still important for responsiveness and background work and all those things. But they're not the answer to using 100 cores to get the answer faster, because that's pillar two. That's parallelism. Here, we used to use thread pools and OpenMP. Now we use PPL, TBB, AMP, those kinds of things fall in this pillar. They're different things. So arguing is MIMD good or is data parallel or task parallel good is missing the point. Yes, of course threading is good, and we should use them better, harness them with active objects, because they solve these problems. And yes, of course, there's no tension here at all because these compose. Of course data and task parallel are good. They solve this problem. Yes, it's true on a web server, using more threads may take up more cores. Pipelining may do that too, because that falls in this category. But they take up to a limited number that's not scalable, except in very rare cases. This is mostly about just expressing independent work, which incidentally may soak up more cores just because you have more work. This is the one about how do I do this computation 100 times faster on 100 cores. So they work together. They're not in tension. They're just different things. They're the two different purposes. By the way, how many of you have seen this slide before? Preach it. Because people always ask questions. It's an excellent question. And here we are 5 years later, and everybody is still asking it. It's the most common question that we get. And it's important to distinguish those two pillars and just understand they're different. They're both good, and they compose. So please fill in the gap between C++ AMP and talking about it magically extending to the cloud versus the trend to have data computation follow data, not data follow computation. How many of you have heard of that tension, data follows computation versus computation follows data? It's actually fairly self-explanatory. It's, do you take the processing to where the data is and do it on that machine or that node or whatever or that device, or do you move the data somewhere else? In GPU, we're currently mostly doing move the data to computation. Data to computation. But we're still doing some of the other because, for example, even in AMP, you can launch multiple successive parallel for eaches that take the other's input or parts of it, output as their input and so forth, and run asynchronously. We can, in the future, under the same programming model, schedule them on the same GPU automatically, knowing, hey, you're using that array. That was last used over here. We'll schedule you over here. There's nothing in the model preventing that. So both are supported. So today, if you look at the way cloud computing is done today for the hardware and infrastructure as a service parts and the compute instances, you typically have two things. You have you have worker roles, which are just basically your little servlets that are on each of these machines, on each of these nodes, waiting for work to do. And you have a queue, which can be instructions or work or data or something. Here, do work on this. And you stick stuff in the queue, and the queue just knows how to have this elastic number of compute nodes pull off of it in a very efficient way. So you can do both, sending data to compute clearly in that path using those existing tools and building right on top of what's already there. And you can take advantage of knowing locality, knowing I last used this data here. Before I copy it back in another queue, which I have control over, let me do more work there because I know it's coming. Or before I copy back, let me see if there's any more incoming work. Oh, look, there is. I'll do that too before I copy back. So there's a lot of engineering we can do under the covers. The goal was, and we'll see how well we did, the goal was to have an interface that you can engineer under without disturbing much the code that you can engineer under to make faster. And a classic example of that is with threading building blocks and the parallel patterns library with the existing parallel for each. You can implement that on top of thread pools or on top of work stealing. It just happens it'll run way faster on top of work stealing. But the guy who wrote the code doesn't know and doesn't care. He just recompiled it and it ran faster. We want to continue that trend because it's worked really well. So when you take this to the cloud, when you say the GPGPU style stuff and say, well, let's just generalize that and say there's just remote cores, who knows what they are, and spread it. You still got to move data potentially. You still got to do your computation, move back. That's the model today. Wouldn't it be nice if we could just have the data somewhere and move the computation to it? Way more efficient because the computation is smaller. There's two things. The first step to moving to the cloud is to do more of what we're doing now, which is moving data to moving the data. Which means if you are using small data, i.e. small is a few gigabytes, that you're running on your desktop and your mainstream machine, that's actually not hard to move out across the cloud because it's pretty tiny. Yeah, we're living in a world where gigabytes are tiny, but it is. I mean, it's just RAM, right? I mean, if it fits in RAM, it's tiny in the cloud sense. If you are compute bound, then doing that is great for your workload. Right, because you need to move stuff over, and then you can do all this compute stuff, and then move the answer back. That is great. So the first step is to look at the compute-bound workloads. Now, the next step is what about the bandwidth-bound workloads? They want to work on huge amounts of data. Now, what you add is a new abstraction, not there now, but you add the abstraction of an array, which doesn't reside in memory, and you can back that up by a cloud if you want to, and then you can do what you want to do.
Let me make a quick addendum to this. I think it's very interesting. I'm going to steal a couple of your minutes for calling your spouse or whatnot. So, but I think this is interesting. This industry is going in cycles, which is something that even within a career, if you're particular, if you're young, it's difficult to detect. It's going in cycles. Like for example, client-server computing. Remember, right? It's back, and you know there's a time when the desktop was it, and then there's this network computing thing which failed, and then there's the cloud computing which succeeded, and so on. So it's just going in cycles. With regard to this particular question, I should add that it's very cyclic and very counterintuitive sometimes. Whether it's good to take the data to the computing, vice versa, what are the relative overheads of communication versus computation, and so on. And for example, tomorrow, we're going to build Google during my big talk. My talk entitled Big, I meant. Don't expect, you know. So we're going to build Google, and we'll see that there's two models of computation which relate directly to taking the data versus to the computation versus the other way around. And we're going to see that essentially Google takes the very counterintuitive approach. It's the more intensive, the more communication intensive, computation intensive approach, which is like, what? But there are other advantages that are not obvious. For example, updating the Google database, which would be much more difficult in the other model. So it's a very complex world we're living in. And the trade-off, the parameters are changing all the time. Like yesterday we had 100 megabit networks, now we have gigabit networks. Yesterday we had spinning disks, now we have SSIDs, and so on. And you know, dynamic RAM is becoming, as slow as the SSID disk, so it becomes I/O. So all of this kind of stuff is changing continuously, and you can have changes of phase in which, we should change the whole way we're organizing the system. So we're going to talk a lot more about that tomorrow.